I'm sorry if you put $2 in the basket tonight because I'm only a $1 speaker. So, you know how you can always tell that you've got a $1 speaker when there's an empty front row. That's how you know I got nobody coming down here to support me tonight. So, but anyway, so what happened, what it's like, and all of that. So. Well, I basically drank my ass off. That's what happened to me. That was my ticket into Alcoholics Anonymous. Was a 27-year drinking career, and mine was a long, slow glide. I could see the end coming from a long, long way away. I mean, I didn't start off as a daily drinker, but I ended as a daily drinker, and I didn't start off miserable, but I ended up miserable, and I didn't start off having, you know, major trouble getting by in life, but I ended up having major trouble getting by in life, and it was just a big straight line from there down to there. And so I started drinking. I grew up in Newport Beach, and I was born in Syracuse, New York, and grew up in New Jersey and Pennsylvania and places like that. Hit California when I was about 12 or 13 years old, and that was a big culture shock, I can tell you that, going from Morristown, New Jersey to Newport Beach, California, so I had a few integration issues to deal with in the fifth grade, and got through that. One thing I've always been blessed with is great confidence, so even though I got picked on a little bit and had to kind of find my way, it was, you know, no really big deal. I just never really gave a crap about what anybody else thought, so, you know, I was pretty much good to go from an early age. And that's lasted a long time. You might even say it's lasted until this very moment. Although I do try to fake it until I make it. So I'm kind of on that program. And I did warn you this was a $1 speech. So, let me tell you a little bit about how I first started drinking. I had friends in the neighborhood. We had that one kid in the neighborhood whose house was very loose. You know, my home was very strict. There was no way anything, you know, untoward was going to go on in, with my parents. That's for damn sure. I made sure I kept my friends away from my house because if my friends ever showed up at my house, my dad would put me to work and all of them to work too. So they knew never to come around. So, but anyway, we had one, I had one friend, his name happened to be Phil, also, and, what a party house that was. That was out of control. He was a Filipino, very, very cool guy, liked Phil a lot. He had cousins, and some of them were his female cousins, and they were pretty attractive, and I was attracted to that, and, he lived with his aunt, and I'm not really sure what the story with his mother was, and the aunt was married to this white guy named Sam, and he was a piece of work, and they had this motorhome and boat and camper, and he had built a home, you know, in the Dover Shores area of Newport Beach, and it was, you know, multi-story and, you know, eclectic and weird, and they would be gone all the time, and we would just party. And, you know, we would throw raging, you know, keg parties and shoot pool and play music loud and have a great time. And even when I would go with them, him and his family out to Lake Havasu, we would sometimes travel out there to go water skiing and stuff like that. And I was the kid that I'd turn a bucket over and, you know, I'm like 14 years old and I'm sitting between Sam and Flo and, you know, smoking a joint with his, you know, step parents while they're in the back playing cards. You know, I wanted to, you know, be doing a little bit more serious partying at the time. So anyway, I remember getting drunk really for the first time out at Lake Havasu. And it's interesting to me now looking back with some sobriety under my belt, just how much of a raging alcoholic I was. You know, even then, I'm pretty sure that I slipped over that line that they talk about, that line that once you go over, you never come back. I'm pretty sure that happened right out of the gate for me. I remember us going and all buying a case of beer down at the local marina and standing. It was just a beautiful summer night. It was one of the big weekends, like July 4th or Memorial Day or, you know, something like that. So tons of people and awesome boats and just raging parties going on all over the place. And standing knee-deep in the water of Lake Havasu, and I proceeded to knock down the entire case. So I drank one case of beer, in a few hours, and blacked out. And woke up the next morning, and these guys, all my buds, were still cracking up, telling me all of the shit that I had done the night before and all the trouble that I had gotten them into and all the camps that we had raided. And I didn't have, you know, very little recollection of any of that. I barely vaguely remember us wandering into some desolate hangar off in the hills somewhere where they were having, you know, the party and seeing cocaine for the first time. And I didn't know what it was. You know, I was 14 years old, and I honestly didn't have any idea. I was like, what's going on over there? You know, what's that all about? And I would, I would catch up with that later on in my career, but I've done my fair share of drugs along the way too, but out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I like to stick to my drinking story when I'm up here. So anyway, didn't have many blackouts after that. You know, it's as if doing that for the first time kind of set, you know, it sort of just set the die, as it were. So I slowly began to increase my drinking. So, you know, I was like a weekend drinker through high school and partied and didn't think too much about it. And then I got into college. I went to UC Irvine. And I was in the engineering school, so I spent 4 years getting a degree in electrical engineering out of UC Irvine. And my drinking accelerated a big amount. Where I had been kind of a beer drinker and a pot smoker in college, now I was a hard alcohol drinker, you know, and way, way too much, you know, gallons and gallons and gallons of liquor, you know, and more than just the weekends, during the week too, and doing other substances along the way, and joining a fraternity, which wasn't a very good idea for an alcoholic, because that really got me raging. And we had a place down in Newport on the coast for a year, and that was a major party house, and so at the end of those 4 years, I barely got out of college by the skin of my teeth. My final technical class was a course in optical electronics, which was kind of a brand new study at the time. And the poor professor felt sorry for me, and the dean of the engineering school wanted anything he could to get me the hell out of there. And so they gave me an A. That I, you know, didn't really earn to pass me in my final class and show me the door and say, would you please leave our campus now? Thank you very much for coming. So that's the way I entered the world. But while I had been there, I had excelled at a few things, one of which was making some connections. So I got hooked into a local Irvine technology company and had a big fat job waiting for me. The day I graduated, I worked for them a little bit before graduating and made an obscene amount of money for a guy at, 22 years old or whatever it was. And my drinking and drug career accelerated further still. So now I've got a big fat expense account, and my bosses are telling me that my expense reports are too low, that I'm obviously not entertaining enough, and that I need to get it up. And so, you know, that off came the gloves, and I went to town. And I was, not particularly good at it. You know, I tried my best to entertain, but my problem is I'd get wasted all the time. So I'd be like the first guy, you know, going down for the count because, You know, I was just a full-blown raging alcoholic at this point. You know, I would just drink as fast as I could, all the time, as soon as I could, and you know, didn't get, like I told you earlier, I just didn't really give a damn about what anybody thought. Bosses, customers, coworkers, anybody else, it didn't really matter to me. And so that lasted for quite a while. And at the end of that early part of my career, I was in that job for 4 or 5 years. I pretty much crashed and burned at that point. That was a big, big wipeout disaster for me. It was, you know, I had to leave that job, and it was pretty humiliating. And so I'm living down in Laguna Beach. I should tell you too that my story is a little bit fragmented because I've lived so many places. I've had in, you know, the last 30 years, I've probably had about 35 addresses. I mean, these are literally addresses that I got mail at that had my name on it and some street address. And I got a job not too many years ago where they did a background check, and I had never had that, had to go through that process before. And there was a choice for you to get a copy of the background check. I said, yeah, what the hell, I'll take a copy. Let's see what they come up with. Because I'd never been like a criminal. I didn't have anything to worry about in my past of any of that kind of stuff. I had managed to avoid the whole jail thing and all of that. God knows how. I certainly deserved to go, certainly for drunk driving. But anyway, I couldn't believe it. It was just page after page after page of addresses, you know. I mean, I've lived in every town down here, every town in Northern California. So anyway, at this particular time, I'm living down in Laguna Beach, Swank. That's where I'm living. It was great. It was right across the street from the Old Mission South Coast Hospital down there. And the mansion places are down below, but these friends of mine had converted the area underneath their garage into like a bachelor apartment. And it was just bitching. Open ocean view and like three-tiered and very swanky. And I was in there holed up. You know, I was isolated. My life consisted of having the pizza guy bring me pizzas and cigarettes and beer. So I, you know, made friends with him. And if you are a good tipper, you can get people to do all kinds of stuff for you that they're not supposed to do. And so that's what I was doing, you know, eating pizza and smoking cartons of cigarettes and swilling gallons and gallons of Budweiser and bemoaning my life. You know, how had it come to this? And I remember in an act of desperation, I actually stopped at that St. Anne's Church one time. And I'm talking like this is way long before I ever got sober. This is 1985, 87, something like that. And, you know, I sat in the back of the church on like a Wednesday night or something like that and was looking for some kind of inspiration. And I was, you know, hoping that, you know, I don't know what I was looking for. I was looking for something. And, you know, I just didn't know that AA was going on like right across the street, you know, at the St. Anne's Women's Center. You know, it was going on right across the street. And I didn't know when I was, I literally was just three doors down from the hospital down there in South Laguna. I didn't know that the AA program was going on over there. You know, I was this close. I was just that close. Something. And it's been brutal in my story to see how close I came to sobriety early on and just missed it. You know, I just didn't make the connection. And how much misery and damage I had to go through until I finally got here. I got sober at 41, and I'm glad for that, you know. And I've come to grips with all of that regret stuff. I don't worry about any of that shit anymore because I realize now that there was nothing that was going to stop the train wreck that I was on. You know, it's just the way my story was. It had to be the way that it was. I'm convinced that God kept me from things that could have killed me or made things much more difficult for me. I think he did the best with me that he could do with what he had to work with. And when my time finally came, I was blessed with the grace to get sober. And I'm okay with that today. So So anyway, I continue to just self-destruct. I begin a process of mass geographics. You know, I would go up to Northern California for a year. I'd come back down here for a year. I'd go to Colorado for a year. I'd go there. I'd come here. And always a new job, always flaming out. And so I got very good at moving. I'm an expert mover. If you've moved a few times where you've got to take a refrigerator and a frickin' couch and a waterbed with you, you just learn that you need to come up with a better plan because that shit gets old really fast. So I just began to whittle things down, and I adopted a lifestyle of minimalism, you know, which is something I still do today. You know, here I am a 49-year-old man, and I can still pack all of my possessions in a single truckload. You give me 20 minutes, and I can be out of anywhere. You know, it is just not a problem. So that's what I would do. I would keep. So here's where I was mentally. I was pissed off, and I was drunk all the time, and I wasn't. I couldn't understand why it seemed that everybody around me was getting things done in life, you know? Even simple stuff. I would watch people walking their dog on the beach, and I'd think to myself, how the hell do you have enough stability in life to have a dog that you can come down and walk them on the beach? I mean, I can't even imagine. You know, if I had a dog, I'd have to move them, right? I mean, I'd have to move them 30 times. That's what my dog's life would be like. I mean, it would be terrible. So, you know, seeing people have life with impunity and seeming to not have the same trouble that I was having was infuriating, you know? And it really grated on me. And so I began to develop, a lot of resentments. I had big resentments against life and everyone and all of you and everything. And it was me against the world, you know, when I first got here. And I was happy to have it be like that, you know, because I didn't, you know, that seems like a fair fight, you know, me against everybody. And I'm okay with that. So, but the point that I'm getting to is where I was in my head is that the only tool that I had in my toolbox was the one that I was taught growing up. And that is you man up, you get up, you dust yourself off, you target your problem. And then you put your head down and you run at it as fast as you possibly can and you run it over. That's the way you get through with life. You know, anything that gets in your way, you just crush it as best you can. You know, you get dirty with it if you have to. You come around and hit it from the side. You take its legs out from underneath of it. You try to get away in the dead of night and not get caught. Whatever it takes, you know, you win, and that's the way it was. So that was the only way that I knew to operate. And finally, what happened to me is I crashed and burned hard enough that I couldn't get myself to up off the ground again. You know, I had run out of money. I was living with a relative. I was. It was time to do the old trick, which was, you know, put on a suit, make yourself look good, you know, dry out as best you can, put on a good face, put up a good fight, and march out into the world and go get another job and maybe another geographic and, you know, start it all over again. And I've done it 30 frickin' times in a row. Why not 31 times in a row? And finally, I was just at the point where I couldn't do it anymore. And I gave up, you know. I was like, I really had enough of this. I don't really know what the problem is, you know. Certainly did not have any inkling that alcoholism was a problem, you know. On a particular day, I might be willing to admit that I had a little bit of a drinking problem. So my drinking at this point is probably about 30 Budweisers a day, okay, and maybe five or six shots of something on top of that, you know, and a couple of packs of cigarettes, and maybe, you know, a couple of big fatties, you know. So that was my, and people in AA are funny. They talk about missing the mark. And I told you my glide was a very slow glide. There was nothing really dramatic. It just accelerated. Every day of my drinking career, it was one day further in the progression. It was a very, you know, straight line kind of a thing for me. I just continued to drink more and destroy myself more. And so I can't remember what I was going to say about that right there, but I'll come back to that. So anyway, I'm drinking a lot. I have an unbelievable consumption for alcohol. I mean, I have an iron constitution. I'm not a projectile vomiter. I'm not a blackout drinker. I just drink mass quantities of everything that I can get my hands on. I mix it all. I drink champagne. I drink wine. I drink whiskey. I drink moonshine. I drink beer. I drink shots. I do it if it's in Jell-O. I don't care. I'll do whatever it is. And you know, I figure I'm good at something, you know? Everybody's got to be good at something, and I am definitely good at that. So anyway, I get to the point where I am pretty destitute, and I've entered the realm of not being in control of my own, you know, I'm not in control as an adult. You know, I've lost my ability to make decisions as an adult. So I have a sister who can see that I'm in trouble. And she comes out to where I am to kind of rescue me. And, you know, I'm basically suicidal at this point. That's what's going on. And so she drags me back here to Orange County. It had been about, 15 years since I had stepped foot in Orange County. It had been a long time. And so I live with her, and it's still now going to be another 2 years before I get sober, you know. But at least I got some place to go, and you know, I'm trying to think about getting a job. And so I begin to engage in what alcoholics do, which is to try to control this thing, you know, through the delusion of controlled drinking. You know, so I play all of those games that we talk about in chapter 3, you know, about mixing things up or, you know, just drinking beer or trying not to drink in the morning or, you know. So here's my solution. So I got a truck, but it has a expired registration tag on it. And the expired, I paid the fees for the tag, so I'm not in any trouble with the law on that, but they've mailed the tag to me, but because of all of my addresses, I don't know where it is. You know, it just keeps going around in a big circle. You know, I can't figure out where, and I'm way too messed up to go to the DMV. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but when you've been, you know, when you're a drunk and a drug user, standing in line at the DMV is not going to happen. You know, that is, you know, thank you. I mean, I would rather get pulled over and written another ticket for, you know, whatever than to go through that freaking nightmare, because that's horrible. You know, I don't want to leave the house. I don't want to have anything to do with authority, you know, life, responsibility. You know, I've got bills. Bills coming in, and I've got enough money in my checking account to handle them, but I can't bring myself to write the check, you know? It's because I just, my head is like, I'll just do it tomorrow. You know, the final year and a half of my drinking was really that. I'll just do it tomorrow. I'll just do it tomorrow. Tomorrow, I'm not in trouble with it today. I probably won't be in trouble with it tomorrow. I'll just put it off. I'll just do it tomorrow. It's like the big book talks about in the earlier chapters when they, I think it's in the doctor's opinion where he talks about alcoholics become losing their ability to be adults and having their problems pile up on them, you know, to an astonishing degree. And that's exactly where I was, is I just couldn't even do the basics. Just couldn't even get the basics done in life. So anyway, I'm doing controlled drinking. I'm drinking regularly at a sports bar over on Crown Valley. It had been my second time through there. I vaguely remember being a local drunk at that bar like 20 years before, and somehow near I'm back here again. But whatever, I can walk to it. So that's the key to that one, is that I can actually get down there and on my own power. I don't have to drive, and so I'm being responsible. I'm not going to be driving drunk. I'm going to walk on down to the bar, and I'm counting up my change, you know, and I'm trying to stiff the barmaid as much as I could for tips so that I could, you know, afford to get one more pitcher, you know, out of the equation during the night. And I had picked that place kind of specifically because it was closed, but also because they closed at 11. That was the deal. They closed at 11, so I knew they'd throw me out at 11. So there was no danger of getting caught in there till 2 a.m., right? So I would go down there, you know, like 10 in the morning or noon or something like that, and then drink my ass off in there all day long, because I'm living with somebody, so I can't drink at home the way I'm used to. I mean, if I can drink at home, I'll just drink there. But if I am in a situation where I can't drink at home, then I got to go out, right? So I'm as comfortable drinking at home as I am in drinking in a bar, as I am in drinking in the woods without anybody else around. It's all the same to me. So I'm engaging in these mind tricks, this delusional thinking of trying to control this thing. And so that was my big idea, was I'm going to visit this place that won't let me stay in there till 2 a.m. And so I won't get picked up by the cops, because, you know you don't get away from, you don't want to drive away from a bar at 2 a.m. Everybody knows that. And, you know, I had been in a lot of bars, so I knew all of the tricks, every single one of them I know. So anyway, but here's what would happen. I would walk down the hill, and I would go in there and I'd drink my ass off all day and shoot pool. And I managed to be a pretty good pool player over all of the years of drinking in bars. So I really enjoyed drinking and shooting pool. And I would leave like about, you know, 10:40, something like that, and get the hell out of there and start walking up the hill. And then by the time I got up to the hill, my buzz would be worn off. I mean, it was just terrible. You know, I had invested my wad that I had for the day, you know. I had consumed mass quantities of alcohol, you know, had played a lot of pool, and had gotten really wasted. And here, you know, a mere half hour later, I'm, you know, stone cold sober, standing at the top of the hill at like 11:15. And so what do? I jump in somebody's car, you know, and drive to a bar that stays open until 2 o'clock in the morning. So my plan to do controlled drinking didn't really work very well. You know, I would always sabotage myself. So anyway, I did a lot of isolated drinking. You know, even if I was in a bar full of people, I was usually by myself. You know, I would kind of make friends with whoever was right here, or whoever was right there, you know, and, you know, we would buy each other drinks and have those bar conversations that you have. And, you know, I was, you know, just there to get the job done was pretty much the situation. And I smoked a lot of pot, too, so so I was talking about people missing the mark. That was the point I forgot a little while ago, and so people are in AA are funny. They talk about missing the mark. I managed to hit the mark, like, every night for 15 years. I mean, it was a beautiful thing. You know, I'd be on a hillside somewhere in the middle of somewhere, you know, sometimes in suburbia, sometimes out in the country. You know, sometimes in the middle of the city, and the night would be beautiful, and I'd be, you know, tanked on, 20 or 30 beers and 5 or 6 shots and smoking a couple of Hooters and just being very, very happy, you know, very at one with the world. Alcohol worked for me. It did from the very beginning, you know. I was just happy to be in that, I guess you'd call it oblivion or pre-oblivion. I mean, that's what I was after when I partied. I wanted to get there, you know what I mean? I mean, I wanted to get from here to there, to that magic place where everything's cool, where I'm just spinning in my head, I'm thinking about stuff, you know, everything is working out, you know, I'm making plans for the future, and they're all working out. And I love that line in the Big Book that says, alcoholics, all of the good things in life were ours for the thinking, you know, and that's the way it was for me. And I would work on my resentments, you know, I would do that too. And I would replay all of the episodes of the past, you know, and all the things that had gone wrong. And I'd rewrite the scripts, and I'd re-speak the lines like they were lines in a play. And I'd think about, you know, I should have said this, and then he would have said that, and then she would have said that, and then they would have meant this, and this would have ended better, and, you know, that would have been good. And, you know, I'd spend some time in that space, and, you know, that's where I was, you know, that's the way that I existed, very, very isolated and very trapped in my own mind and not particularly unhappy about it. What happens to me, like what happens to so many of us, is the alcohol at some point stops working, you know, it's not effective in producing that effect anymore. And at that point, things get difficult because reality starts to stick its ugly head in, and it's hard to not spend time thinking about all of the stuff that is going wrong that you should be doing something about, but you're just pushing off until tomorrow, you know. And so life gets very difficult and very very miserable. So I am pretty unhappy at this point. I'm beginning to contemplate a suicide plan. I've been rescued by my one sister, and it's now 2 years have gone by, and my alcoholism has done nothing but get worse. I'm not able to identify it as the problem. If I try to explain what's happening to people, and I would say I drink because I'm unhappy, and I'm unhappy because I'm broke. And that was the equation that was in my head. If I could just figure out the being broke part, you know, like win the lottery or get another one of these great jobs or something, then I would be happy. And if I could get back to being happy, then I'd be able to man up and do something about the drinking problem. So I had it completely backwards, but that, you know, made sense to me. So what finally happened that brought me to my knees and what drove me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is I came back from this sports bar that I was mentioning earlier one night. I had been drinking all day, as I had been doing for, you know, 15 or 20 years. I was a daily drinker for about 20 years. I would maybe come up for air a day or two during the year, you know, maybe a week at a time, something like that, if, you know, the situation called for it. But, you know, I was drunk every day for, you know, most of that time. You know, I didn't care whether I had been to the dentist or had oral surgery or, you know, my all four quadrants of my mouth could be numb with Novocaine, and I'd be showing people in the bar how the drink would run down my face, you know, and think that was funny, you know. I thought it was funny as hell to drink with a mouthful of Novocaine. It was hilarious. And so I come back, hike up that damn hill, sobers me up. I get into the backyard. It's in the evening, you know, I don't know, 9 or 10, something like that. And I'm talking to God, which I was wont to do when I was inebriated. I would spend a lot of time talking to God. My concept of God at that time was me and God against the world. You know, I had a relationship with God. I just figured he was on my side and saw things my way. And that pretty much was it. And I, so I was talking to God, and I was trying to get him to explain to me, you know, why was it like this? I mean, what the hell is going on here? You know, what are you doing? And I remember calling out, just like I'm speaking to you now, and I said, you know, when are you going to do something about this? And I think I used some bad language in there, too. I had some other. When I got angry with God, I would call him every name in the book, by the way. I, you know, it's good that God is so forgiving, because I've called him the worst that you can call him, I've called him. And in sobriety, I've called him those things, too. So I'm glad that the recovery has been very, very slow, let me tell you. So I remember having a thought, the first time I had ever had this thought, which was, maybe I'm crazy. And it was the first time I had really thought that. It's like, you know what? Maybe what's going on here is I'm nuts. I must be out of my freaking mind. And that made sense to me because I thought, you know what? Don't they say that people who are crazy, they don't know they're crazy, right? That's what they say. It's like, that's what's going on. I don't know that I'm crazy, so I must be crazy. That must be the answer. So I was beginning to think about that, and I was aware that something physical was going on because I would tell people, you know, it's weird. I don't seem to have an off switch, you know. I just don't seem to be able to stop once I get started. And so I was beginning to kind of comprehend some small part of this thing we call alcoholism, but I had no idea what the ramifications are or what any of that meant. But, you know, I was beginning to nip on it a little bit. And so I finally did say to God, I said, when are you going to do something about this? You know, obviously, I can't do anything about this. I'm crazy. I've just admitted to you that I'm crazy. I spend most of my time thinking about suicide. You know, here's my suicide plan. Let you and me run through this once again, you know. Because I don't want there to be a big problem when I see you face to face in a little while. I want you to understand, you know, why it had to happen this way. I don't want to have a big argument with you, God. You know, let's just get this all cleared up now. And so I yelled, you know, in a loud voice in that backyard, when are you going to do something about this? And so some weird things happened. And, well, basically what happened was this. I had been home alone. There was nobody else in the house, nobody in the backyard. And the next morning, I'm standing back in the backyard again. Of course, I had gone to bed and slept and got up. And now I'm in the backyard. And I smoked at the time, so I'm back there smoking. And my sister, the one that had come out and rescued me 2 years before, sticks her head out the window and she says, hey, I made an appointment for you to see a psychiatrist and it's this morning at 10 and I just, you know, need you to know that you have to go, you know, or something to that effect. And so I mentioned earlier this part about, you know, losing your ability to be an adult. And that's the realm that I was in, is now my life is being run by, you know, a younger sister. I'm an adult man with a, you know, college degree and a professional career behind me. And yet my life is now being run by someone else, you know, because I'm not capable of, you know, facing responsibility and taking care of the basics. And so, you know, I'm kind of basically shuffling around like this, you know, my head down, looking at my feet, and this is the deal, you know. She's going to force me to go see this stupid shrink, and I, you know, what am I going to say? I mean, I don't really have any choice, you know. It's I've resigned decision making. So the weird part about that story to me is that years later, I found out that my sister had made that appointment for me a week in advance. So she didn't want to spring it on me until the very last day. She didn't want to give me any wiggle room to squirm away. So after 27 years of drinking, finally one night I break down and finally have it out with God, you know, and finally make some demands about help, you know, and when are you going to do something about this? And the next day, you know, less than 12 hours later, I'm standing in a frickin' shrink's office, you know, and my recovery started there. My recovery started that day. That was the last drink I had, was that night that I called out for help, asked God when he was going to do something. That was June 3rd of 2003. I walked up the hill from the sports bar drunk for the last time. So I went in and saw the shrink and kind of warmed up to it, because I'm a bit of an experimentalist type. I always like doing, you know, different stuff. So that's kind of the way I saw it. I was like, oh, what the hell, I'm going to go see the shrink. Never really saw a shrink before, so, you know, this should be an interesting life experience, you know. I wasn't planning to lie to him or hide anything, or it's like, you know, I recognize that he's a career person doing his job and probably good at what he does. And so anyway, I went in to see him, and we had a pretty frank conversation, and he asked me questions that are similar to our question, you know, our pamphlet in here, the 20 questions, and I answered those honestly. And anyway, the final result of that was that I had a choice. It was to go to detox or to go homeless. That was the choice that my sister and that damn shrink left me with. And, you know, I had been close to homelessness a few times, but never really had done the deal. And I knew that I was a wuss. There was no way I was going to be one of these survivor types, you know, on the street. I marvel when I sit out there and hear people get up here and talk about, you know, their ability to survive, you know, in a homeless status for months and years and the things that they do. And it's, I mean, the ingenuity of being able to do that, I just do not have those skills. I would be, I don't know what I would do. It would not end well, I'll tell you that. I wouldn't last 3 days on the street. So, obviously, my hands were tied. I had to, and something happened to me right then. It was basically a surrender. I knew that some chapter was closing and some unknown chapter was opening, and I resigned myself to whatever this new thing was going to be, it was going to be. And I shuffled out of his office again with my head down, looking at my feet, thinking, how did this happen? I mean, how did I get to this point? But, you know, that was it. Something different was going to happen, and that's the way it was going to be. So I did go through the emergency room at the Mission Hospital down there in, I think they call it Mission Hospital now. It was the South Orange County Medical Center back then. And had some medical issues going through the emergency room that weren't very good. And they put me up on the fourth floor, and I wore one of those little things. I never had one of those things on my, and I scratch, and I don't like anything. I don't wear any jewelry of any kind, or I don't like any of that stuff. So, and I was very dejected, you know, and ashamed and humiliated and fearful and despondent. And it was a sad time, you know. I had I was losing my best friend, and I didn't really appreciate that in all of its you know, for all that that was worth. And so I went in there, and they did whatever they do to make the withdrawal symptoms less. I think they give you some things. I don't really know what they gave me. I just did whatever I was told. And this thing says 10:17. It's not really 10:17, is it? Wow, I'm really sorry about that. You guys should definitely ask for a refund. So, anyway, I got into detox, and part of that was to take you to a few AA meetings. So I went to my first AA meeting, was on June the 5th or 6th or so of 2003, and it was down in the big auditorium room of the South Coast Medical Center. And I looked around. I thought, this is really a pretty weird deal down here. And then there was a little speaker. I don't remember who it was, male, female, couldn't tell you what they talked about, don't know. Whatever it was interesting. They gave me a little 24-hour newcomer chip. It was pink, and it was a keychain thing. And I was like, thank you very much. That's pretty cool. And then what happened is, in the second half of the meeting, people would stand up and share, you know. And they were talking about this big book. You know, everybody was big book this, big book that. I was like, oh my God, they've got a book. They got a name for it. They call it the big book. And at the end of everybody's share, they would say, and thank you for letting me share. And I was like, oh, that is so pathetic. You know, thank you for letting me share. And I was just, I was embarrassed for them, you know. But something definitely happened, and the way I describe it now is that I was absolutely shocked. I could not believe that these people would jump up and share from the heart the way that they did about dirty laundry, you know, about personal stories that were obviously painful, and people would laugh at them, you know. And, you know, everybody was kind of in on some joke that I didn't really get at the time. You know, I didn't really understand it. But I was, being as isolated as I was, I just couldn't fathom that people would be willing to do what these people were doing right in front of me. I spent a lot of nights pondering, you know, what would cause a person to do that. You know, I just couldn't figure it out. You know, it took a long time for me to understand that they were there for me that night. That that's exactly what they were doing, was giving something of themselves so that I could see the grace of God and survive this terrible, miserable thing. And so I graduated from detox after 4 days and got into a recovery house. And did a month or so there, and I was in the recovery house for about a week before I actually got my first big book. You know, people had been talking about it for a week and a half, but I hadn't actually ever seen one. You know, I didn't really know what it was. I knew it was blue, apparently. And so finally, you know, I guess the price of my rehab ticket included the cost of a big book, which was awfully damn nice of them, let me tell you. And so they provided it in my little tote bag with all of my other rehab gear, you know. And so I opened it up and I started to read. And I didn't read the doctor's opinion first. I started in chapter one and I read Bill's story. And I was really, really identified a lot with Bill Wilson and his story, and began to have, you know, some kind of moments of clarity, spiritual awakening, that sort of thing, and saw, you know, alcoholism for the first time. You know, Bill's story introduced me to alcoholism for the very first time. And I began to get the idea that there was alcoholic drinking and it was different from normal drinking. I had never considered that before. I always thought everybody was basically the same. I thought the reason that you didn't drink the way that I did is because you just couldn't keep up, or you had made a number of poor life decisions that didn't allow you to party like I did, like maybe you got married, that's always a bad thing, or had children, or maybe you got one of those dogs that you got to run around on the beach with, you know. I didn't have any of that baggage. I was able to drink, you know, all the time, anytime I wanted. So this idea that there were normal people who were happy to just have a drink or two and then leave it alone, unbelievable. It's like finding out that somebody, that there's people who speak a language other than English and never knowing that before. You know, it's like people talk a different language? Is that real? It sounds like words, but they're not really words, are they? Sounds like gibberish to me. So I also learned that it was the first drink that was getting me drunk, not the last one, you know. Never understood that. You know, I always thought, oh, I'm pretty safe with just a drink or two, you know, right? No harm done. What's a little drink or two? That's not going to cause any trouble. And I just didn't know that I was losing control and that to have one, you know. So we have a saying in here for that, that one is too many and a thousand's not enough. And then I learned about the very hard, hard, harsh truth, the big one, that once a pickle, never a cucumber again. And that one was brutal. That was truly, truly brutal to come face to face with the idea that the damage had been done, that I was an alcoholic through and through. I was like a man who had lost my legs. I would never grow new ones. There was no going back. The solution was not to just stop. You know, I wasn't going to just stop and have everything be okay. Just stopping was only the first very beginning part of this deal, you know, that was the babiest of all baby steps, was just stopping, you know, total abstinence. You know, that was crushing, absolutely crushing to learn that truth about alcoholism. So anyway, I did read the book, and it changed my life. You know, the scales fell from my eyes, my delusional thinking began to break, and one delusion after another began to fall, and I was confronted with the idea that I had thought I knew how life worked, what reality was, and I found out that I didn't, that I was in error, and that I was going to have to do something about all of that, and that this was going to be a lifelong process, clawing back and doing this program and getting involved. And so I've tried to do that. So I went from rehab. They took me to a lot of AA meetings. I like to say that I went through detox and then rehab and then into the warm, loving embrace of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been here ever since. That's been about 8.5 years. And I'm one of the lucky ones in the sense that I had the obsession to drink removed from me long about the time I took the third step in rehab. I took the third step in rehab on my knees with a heroin addict as my witness and said the third step prayer, you know, and moved on to the fourth step. And the compulsion to drink has never returned. I don't jones for a drink. Life's a bitch, you know, that's for sure. Dealing with life sober is sometimes not fun, you know, but solving it with drinking and using drugs, it just doesn't ever come up. And I'm very, very blessed for that. I can't even imagine going back to the way that it was. I can't even imagine that I used to do the things that I did. I'm pleased to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad that you guys asked me to speak tonight, and I hope that I was able to share my story honestly and perhaps help in some small way. And with that, I think I'll say goodnight. Thank you.